handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over. Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989er, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds HEBT, gas TOT 53.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you hung with us here on the Denise Simon Experience, and our faithful listeners to WDDQ Talk 92.1. EJ and Tony has been kind enough to accept the invitation to join us. He is one of our more brilliant people over there at the Heritage Foundation when it comes to the federal budget and looking at all the stories that real numbers tell. He's one of the talented people that can tell you what's really happening with numbers instead of the spin. So we're actually going to talk about the possibility of a housing collapse. But EJ and Tony, welcome back. And I appreciate your passion over there on X, or otherwise known as Twitter.
Well, thank you for having me.
Balance sheets. I'm real fretful, and tell me if I'm nuts or not. But these banks, they have some interesting things that are happening with these loans, not only in the commercial realm, but in the residential realm. And some of these big corporations are just really giving their properties back to the banks and saying, we're walking away from it. And I think that necessarily hurts. And then you end up with blighted downtown areas, or, you know, commercial properties that end up being vacant for a very long time and can't be leased. And so then these banks would necessarily take a look at their residential loans and see what is happening there. Is there some truth to that?
Oh, certainly. You know, we're seeing increasingly essentially loans go bad. And you may say, well, how does something like a loan go bad? The problem is that a loan is just a promise to pay, right, or a promise to repay. And as people can't make good on that promise, what's the result? Well, the result is the bank's not going to get paid. So that's a loss for the bank. And that becomes problematic when you realize that banks don't keep your money in a vault. They loan it out. And when they start losing money, that means there's not enough money to pay you back the money that you put on deposit. And obviously, there are a whole host of other concerns, such as if banks don't have enough money, then there's an inability for them to write you a loan, whether it's for, you know, a credit card or a mortgage for a house, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing all kinds of stress in the banking sector today. We are increasingly seeing some red flags that point to some of the phenomena that you're describing, whether it's in the commercial real estate market where office buildings are simply just vacant today, or it's residential where people are having a tough time making their mortgage payments.
Well, a lot of people inside their mortgage payments have to pay for homeowners insurance. And while they may be able to afford one, they can't necessarily afford the other, because homeowners insurance is absolutely exploded. I'm watching people that are desperate to, you know, find insurance companies that will insure them at something lower than what they're paying. Florida is outrageous, and I think California is too. And so that I think the insurance piece prices a lot of people out of the market. Yes?
Oh, certainly. And part of the problem that people are facing today is that they previously got a mortgage when interest rates were very, very low at, you know, 2 to 3%. and they thought they were getting a great deal, and they thought they could afford a very large monthly mortgage payment. And they could, but that was before prices went up 20% for everything else that they buy. And so once you realize, oh my goodness, food is up, things like insurance, as you mentioned, those have gone through the roof. Home insurance on average is up something like 25% in the last 3 years. It's insane. And all of these additional costs are eating into the family budget. Well, then at the end of the month, families increasingly don't have enough left to make their monthly mortgage payment. And so even those who got got a fixed rate mortgage, so the cost of their home is locked in, even they are experiencing a tremendous amount of financial stress right now and a general inability to be able to comfortably make their mortgage payment.
Over the years, EJ, there have been some very creative loan plans. There was the adjustable rate, and then there's the no doc loans, and then there's no down payments, and then there's, you know, all these other kinds of things. And suddenly, I'm not seeing a lot of those very creative loans that are happening. Am I missing something there?
Well, we have to remember that these things, when they happen, they don't get a lot of attention. So the mortgages that started going bad in 2005, 2006, 2007, they were originated several years before, 3, 4, 5 years before. And when that was happening, they weren't getting a lot of attention. It was only when things started to go bad that they got a lot of attention. You know, people don't necessarily pay attention to a hidden stick of dynamite, but everyone pays attention when they hear a big boom. So that's basically what happened back then. And that's probably what's starting to happen right now, where essentially people in, let's say, 2020, who got a mortgage that was fixed, had a fixed rate for the first 5 years, but then is a variable interest rate for the next 25 years, when are those higher interest rates going to kick in? Mm-hmm. Next year. And so we don't even have a lot of those problems rearing their ugly heads yet. That is still yet to come. But sadly, that is already baked into the cake.
We had a little bit of a blip on the radar of some banks that had failed a couple of months ago, several months ago. Is there a possibility, because people are just walking away from some of these loans? I know that car loans, it's happening with some mortgages, and obviously in commercial. Is there a chance that we're going to have some new inventory of bank failures?
Oh, it's certainly possible. You know, banks have about almost $500 billion of unrealized losses sitting on their balance sheets right now. So the sector is certainly under a lot of stress. There's a lot of trouble, particularly in the regional banks right now. And I think it's important to remember that so much of our banking system is unfortunately built on fraud. It is built on this idea that banks can make multiple claims on the same dollar. They can have they can tell you that you have a dollar on deposit when you really don't. They have loaned that dollar out to somebody else. And so if we all tried to get our money all at once from the banks, we'd very quickly realize it's not there.
It's not there.
Again, right. They operate on a fraudulent principle.
So what happens? We have in so many parts of the country, we have housing shortages. And in other parts, we have vacancies, or those that, you know, people just can't sell because the seller doesn't necessarily have a place to go, or, they're priced out of the market because of the cost and because of the insurance. What happens here, EJ?
Well, we're increasingly seeing Americans, particularly young people, move back in with family or get into situations where they're getting roommates, even in cases where they just have a one-bedroom apartment. People are squeezing into an increasingly small number of dwellings because they simply can't afford to live on their own these days. and that's very likely going to continue. You know, another sign of the times, I think, is that storage facilities, so if you like rent a storage unit, let's say, have seen a huge increase in their occupancy rates. In other words, what percentage of those storage units are being used month to month. Why? Because as people can't afford to live on their own anymore, and as they move back in with family, let's say, they don't need a lot of their stuff anymore, like certain pieces of furniture, and they need a place to store it.
I happen to buy storage units from time to time, so I understand that little sector of the industry quite well. And you know, it's pretty fascinating how many people just walk away from stuff. And some of these units are 20 feet by 30 feet, which can really hold a whole house. So yeah, I understand that one. How do we get to a housing shortage?
Oh, goodness. You know, it may sound like an oversimplification. It may sound like it's completely disconnected, but simply too much government spending. Now, okay, how on earth do we get from A to Z there? Well, let's walk through the chain of events. When the government spent trillions upon trillions of dollars, it didn't have, the Federal Reserve needed to print the money to pay for those deficits. When that happened, it created massive inflation, the worst inflation in 40 years. That drove up costs everywhere, including for housing. In order to combat that inflation, the Fed then hiked interest rates hard and fast, which drove up borrowing costs, including the cost to borrow for a home, right? The interest rate on your mortgage went through the roof. And so people trying to buy a home today now not only have to pay much more for the mortgage, but they have to pay more to borrow on that mortgage. So your principal went up, your interest went up, your monthly mortgage payment has gone through the roof. It has literally doubled on a median price home today compared to January of 2021. In terms of people, though, who got their homes when mortgage rates were very low and before those prices went through the roof, they have a relatively low mortgage payment. Now, the problem here is that if I need to, let's say, move because I'm trying to switch jobs or something and I have to relocate, what happens? Well, I have to sell my home and I lose my mortgage, and I'm going to get a new mortgage, not at 2-3%. But at 7%, maybe even 8%. And the problem there is that even if I borrow the same amount, my monthly mortgage payment will go up dramatically. So now I need to sell my current home at a premium, at a very high price, in order to have a much bigger down payment so I don't have to borrow as much, so that I'll have a more reasonable monthly mortgage payment. Okay, so that has severely restrained the supply of existing or used homes. What about new homes? Well, home builders today are facing incredibly high construction costs because of inflation. It has driven up the price of everything. And so that has reduced the number of homes that home builders can produce, which in turn has reduced the supply of new homes to the market. So the supply of both new and existing homes has been severely hamstrung. And that's how we arrive at this incredible housing shortage and home affordability crisis that we have today.
You know, a lot of people rent cars because they, you know, as soon as you drive a car off a lot, it loses its value. So rather than, you know, buy a new car and finance it, they just, you know, say that part of their monthly expense is going to be a car lease. Well, I think there is a sizable group of people that just said, you know, home ownership will never be in my possibilities. Although it's a dream, it'll never be in the possibilities. So they resign themselves to be renters for the rest of their lives. So there's also apartment you know, housing shortages for people to rent houses. There's that shortage too, because those monthly costs have just gone through the roof. I mean, I'm seeing people renting a house that's 900 square feet for $3,000 a month. That's outrageous, right?
Oh, certainly. You know, we've never seen the cost of shelter this high before, whether we're talking home ownership or we're talking renting. But you know, some of what you're hinting on here is that as people increasingly give up on the dream of ever being able to own a home, they aren't saving for a down payment anymore, and so they just spend that money. It's a phenomenon that, that we call doom spending. And so that is really helping to keep the consumer expenditures or consumer spending figures in the economy very high today. But it's actually not a sign of wealth. It's a sign of impoverishment.
Desperation.
Certainly. Yep. Desperation would be another very good word for it. Absolutely.
The other piece is utility bills. I mean, we talked about insurance. I mean, that's just, you know, almost ridiculous. Well, it is ridiculous. But the power bill, the cable bill, the water bill, I mean, we're watching all of them increase exponentially, too. I mean, we're getting to the point where it's an impossible situation. And yet we have an administration that only really talks about lowering the cost of healthcare, which I would argue then change the name from the Affordable Care Act to the Unaffordable Care Act. So, you know, and they want to get rid of all of these other fees that you have on your credit cards or, you know, boarding fees if you get on an airplane and so forth, which they say it saves you $600 a year. Well, a lot of people don't even fly anymore because they can't afford that either. So, I mean, we're really in a mess that the administration just doesn't understand, but you see it all pretty clearly as you go through these financials. Is that right?
Well, let me just say that it's not a $20 so-called junk fee, which who gets to define what a junk fee is, right? But whatever the case, it's not a $20 fee on your credit card statement each month that is causing people to fall behind. It's the fact that they are spending thousands of dollars more per year on rent. They are spending thousands of dollars more per year on food. They are spending hundreds of dollars more per year on clothing, et cetera. And so those are the things that are really causing the American people to fall behind, to not be able to make ends meet. That, you know, that's causing them to live paycheck to paycheck, to go into debt, to deplete their savings. What the Biden administration has essentially done is try to scapegoat business and say it is their fault that you are worse off today than you were 3 or 4 years ago, when in reality, the exact opposite is the case. Businesses are simply passing along costs to consumers. And actually, the Biden administration's own data proves this, because if you look at the prices that you, I, and the listeners pay, and then you compare that to the prices that businesses pay, both have risen about 19% during the Biden administration. In other words, when you go to the grocery store and you're trying to buy a gallon of milk, if it is up, let's say, 25%, the cost that the business paid to put that gallon of milk on the shelf has also increased by about 25%. And so the business is simply passing those costs on to you. So far, far from grocery stores gouging consumers or whatever kind of rhetoric the Biden administration wants to use, they are simply doing business. You know, I would love to know how businesses all of a sudden miraculously became greedy all at once in January of 2021. Or maybe there was something else that happened at that same time, which caused prices to go up so dramatically.
A year from now and 2 years from now, will the situation look the same as it does today, EJ?
You know, unfortunately, I think it's going to get worse. I don't see a lot of positive news coming down the pike, because I don't see a lot of good choices being made today. I see a government which continues to spend money that we don't have. I see a Federal Reserve which has no intention of getting inflation down to the 2% target, much less to zero, which is where it should be. And so I, unfortunately, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm not all that hopeful.
I'm not either, to be honest with you. And so people generally try, you know, that those have the ability, they trying to be pretty savvy. You know, they're taking second jobs, or they're doing side hustles, you know, whatever they possibly can. You know, they're trying real hard to cut down on their food bills. They may be growing a small little garden to, you know, do their own tomatoes or whatever. I mean, there are people that are working pretty hard at making all of these expenses manageable, whatever they can. But that still probably leaves 70% of a certain part of the population that, you know, doesn't have those abilities. And so could we end up with another, not just housing collapse, but a economic collapse here in a year or so?
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible. If you look at things like the Great Depression, for example, what made the Great Depression possible was not a single public policy failure, but a continued succession of public policy failure after public policy failure. And so as long as you have politicians in place who frankly don't know what they're doing and maybe even have an incentive to make the wrong decision, then you will see those public policy failures in quick succession. And we've seen that already the last several years. So unfortunately, this is, again, part of the reason why I'm not particularly hopeful at the moment, is because we have a lot of bad people in place and they have some very bad incentives.
So for the, you know, for the sake of argument, we have a new administration. We have a new person in the White House. What would be the two most important things you would have this new president do in cadence with Congress to address this situation?
Well, in terms of what the executive branch can do on its own, that would be deregulation. That was something we saw during the Trump administration, for example, and it was incredibly successful. We also saw that during the Reagan administration, and that was also very, very successful. But what the executive branch can do in collaboration with Congress, cut spending and cut it dramatically. That it's amazing how many of our economic ills today all trace back to excessive levels of government spending. And so getting that down is really key to getting us out of this mess.
Yeah, I think regulations is a big part of it. But if you know, they wouldn't, nobody goes for the penny plan. Take one penny out of every dollar, but at this point, we're going to need to take 10 or 20 cents out of every dollar spent at the federal level, correct?
Much more than that.
More than that? You know, I knew you were going to say that.
You know, when you realize that government spending, and this is just direct government spending, not indirect spending, where like the government gives money to someone and then that other person spends the money, just what the government spends is something like a fifth of our economy. You need to get it down from not 20%, but down to about 3% to have any kind of you know, long run success. So we have a very, very long way to go here if we have any, if we're going to have any hope of turning this thing around.
And that includes money that leaves our land going to foreign places that have never necessarily seen again. You know, that tells us too that when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, those programs are going to be in very, very bad shape. But maybe if somebody like E.J. Antoni introduces a piece of legislation to somebody over there in Congress that says, hey, all of you senators and all you Congress people, House of Representatives, we need you to cut your staff by 50%. Would that get anybody's attention?
Well, I'm going to leave it to people. I'm going to leave it to the lawyers to draft the actual legislation. But we need cuts that go far beyond simply legislative staff. Let me say that.
E.J. Antoni, research fellow for the Grover Hermann Center of Federal Budget. Are we in for another housing collapse? Thanks for this discussion, E.J. I appreciate you. I watch you over there on Twitter, otherwise known as X, or X, otherwise known as Twitter. And I appreciate the passion. I hope you continue to gain some real attention and and traction on all of this. Thanks for sharing some time with us. Ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way. Stay with us.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
It's what we were taught, trained, and told to do.
It could be for anything. Helping a friend move.
Listening to a fellow veteran for hours, at any hour of the day.
Or just simply making time for people. A neighbor, a loved one, or even a stranger.
We're often the first to help others. There's no question about it.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
Perhaps it's time to do for yourself what you would do for others.
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. J. Michael Waller has been kind enough to join us once again. He is a former CIA stationed in Central America, and he is the proud author of the book, Big Intel. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about how the progressives are changing up the definition of words, and when they're not doing that, they're telling us we can't use certain words. And I would say that's part of the risk adverse problem that we're experiencing domestically and globally. So, Michael Waller, thanks again for coming back with us.
Hi, Denise.
We can't call jihadists jihadists. We can't call illegals illegals. They're, what are they called? Newcomers. And you know, none of this is helping at all. Even when it comes to Israel and Hamas, they keep saying Hamas and other groups, but they won't tell us what the other groups are, which is otherwise known as the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So they just ignore words. Did I get some of that right?
You did. Like, you can't say boys and girls anymore, or ladies and gentlemen. It's and you can't even say that in the intelligence community now. It's you know, it's getting to be that bad. So yeah, you've nailed it.
Well, look, you know, it's not just permeating through universities, but it's happening at the State Department. It's happening at the Pentagon, which says to me that it's happening at the National Security Council. How do we unwind some of this, Michael?
Well, it's not just happening in these places. It has been imposed on these places, and everybody has gone along. I don't know if a single general or admiral who has publicly made an issue of this or resigned over it. And it's not a petty thing, because when you can no longer call the enemy by
the
name,
enemy.
Yeah, you can't even say that anymore in many places. Even in the Defense Department's own dictionary, they removed the definition for enemy, and they've removed the definition for victory. They don't exist anymore. So the people out there are deliberately changing our vocabulary so that they change the way we speak, and then they change the way we think, and then change the way we act. And if this is happening visibly, like we can see all around us, it's happening just as badly inside our intelligence community.
If you were the president getting a presidential daily briefing, which I would argue that into itself is probably gone woke, then I would say those that are compiling the presidential daily briefing are doing a disservice. Yes?
Yes, and it comes through the whole system so that the briefer just gets the bottom line. It doesn't get all of the material that goes, all the ingredients that go into the brief. So when you have people all the way down the line not saying certain things and calling things by what they are not, that permeates to the top whether the briefer is a, you know, is a good guy or not. And then that mm-hmm. affects the final product to our leaders.
What do we do? I know that Governor DeSantis here has, in fact, he's working diligently to get rid of all DEI stuff, wherever it resides in the state of Florida. And, you know, he's part of the Republican Governors Association. And I'm not seeing yet a lot of these other governors in that association doing this kind of work. Are you?
No, maybe Texas, maybe Arkansas or Missouri. Maybe Louisiana, but not so much. It's more driven by the legislature. But still, you have very, very few states doing it. And DeSantis is doing a magnificent job leading courageously and basically not listening to all the whining and kicking and screaming when he makes a change. And he's not even making a change towards something different. He's just making a change to back where it was when it was normal.
Where did all this come from? Do you know? I mean, in some of this work, or is this coming from some kind of foreign entity? I mean, do we have some Marxists within the administration that is concocting all of this and it's being perpetuated on TikTok and in social media? I mean, help me with some of the background on where we are with, you know, I mean,
this is what I should. Yeah.
Help me.
Well, I set out to find the answer when I began writing the book, Big Intel. Was looking at how the Obama administration started it and then continued through Trump and up until the present under Biden and Obama again. But it began long before that, and this was a surprise. You try to unravel that red thread, as Diana West calls it, that red thread continuous, unbroken chain of ideological custody. So where did it begin under Obama and by whom, and how were they influenced? And how were those influencers influence until you get back to the origins? And if you pull on that red thread, you will see, and Obama has even mentioned these names, as have some of his others. One of the so-called philosophers that he studied when he was at Occidental College was someone named Herbert Marcuse. And Marcuse and others were the primary people behind what we see today as diversity, equity, and inclusion. They called it critical theory. Others call it cultural Marxism, and it's a way, it's a form of Marxism that instead of pitting the rich against the poor or the poor to overthrow the rich, because right now you have so many billionaires who are Marxist, that model doesn't work. But even a century ago, it wasn't going to work. So they decided, this was at a meeting 102 years ago, in 1922 at the Marx Engels Center in Moscow, Marx Engels Institute, to create institutions in the West to tear apart Western societies from within and to have Westerners themselves do the work to rip everything apart, all traditions, all history, all values, all morals, all, you know, all principles that made our civilizations great, to tear them apart so that there would be nothing left but this vacuous state of nothingness, so that the Marxists could come in and take over.
Well,
one of the people present at that meeting, Denise, was the founder of what became the Soviet KGB, Felix Dzerzhinsky. He was there, so this began as a Soviet intelligence campaign over 100 years ago. It wasn't even aimed at us at the time. It was aimed at Germany. That ended up outliving the Soviet Union.
Well, you know, I was watching, don't laugh at me, Michael, but I was watching something on the Boston Tea Party last night, and I learned some stuff that was never in our history books. But the Patriots, if you will, trying to figure out what to do with these ships that were bringing cargo of tea into the Boston Harbor, they went around, the Patriots went around with white paint and put painted tea on doors and windows of all the people that were siding with the Tories. I almost feel like we ought to start identifying these people as being advocates for Marxism and painting M's on doors and windows or around businesses and offices and so forth. So do we start there to kind of fix this?
Well, that's fine, because they're certainly marking all of us.
Yes.
When you think of the intelligence industrial complex where you have now really maliciously led intelligence services that were supposed to, you know, their purpose is to defend our constitutional way of life. But they're not doing that anymore. They're exploiting our freedoms and exploiting the Constitution to wreck it from within. And they have electronically marked all of us. If you look at the Twitter files, you can see how that was done on what turns out to have been a small scale. Well, believe it or not, you know, the FBI going to Twitter and other intelligence agencies going to Twitter and other social media and marking people that way and then silencing them, making them what Orwell called unpersons. So they're doing it to us. So I think fair is fair. You're onto something.
Are the bad guys winning?
Yes, they're winning, but they've done us a great favor in that they've shown their hand and they've gotten so cocky and so careless that they think they can act with impunity when really they've awakened the public. And even just this morning, actually, I got a phone call from somebody who I knew years ago. He's a Democrat lawyer who called me up and wants to chat about the book because he agrees with it. As long as I promise not to tell who he is. So this there, even you have some honest liberals who are worried about wokeness, because wokeness is far beyond just liberalism. It's cultural Marxism. And so he's concerned that, as a Democrat, he's concerned that our country is in terrible trouble if this continues.
Are these people in your work, certainly with the book Big Intel, how the CIA and FBI went from Cold War heroes to deep state villains? Was there a handful of things that you were writing down on a piece of paper that caused you to say, I've had enough? In other words, there were too many burrs under your saddle that you had to write this book?
Oh, that had already happened. Yes. So I had left Washington, D.C. and went out to a rural area and built my own house. And I thought, I'm sick of Washington. I want nothing to do with it anymore. And then people were saying, so my friend said, you know, that's the coward's way out. You can go out to the countryside for a break, but you can't leave.
And self-preservation.
Your whole life. Yeah, really. Yeah. You need to take a break, but I just wanted to say, you know,
declare your head.
I'm done. I'm just done. Well, then, so I'm out there, and I got a call from the editor at Regnery Publications, the publishers, and they said, would you like to write a book on the you know, how the CIA's gone woke and everything? And I thought about it and said, if you throw in the FBI, yeah, you got a deal, because people need to know. And I really need to speak out for people who are still on the inside who can't say anything. Or more properly, they won't say anything because they don't want to lose their positions or their pensions. But those of us who were not, we were close to the inside, but we were never working for the swamp. Sort of, it's a duty when you know these things to pass it on and then to see what can be done about it.
Well, I mean, just when you think of Afghanistan, the rules of engagement changed up, were forced to be changed up under the Bush administration. I would argue he didn't want it that way, but nonetheless, it changed up to winning the hearts and minds. And we think that we're winning hearts and minds, but we're not doing that. We're actually capitulating with these enemies. And I would argue that these enemies, whatever the wider scope of the definition of enemies is today, they're not embarrassed about being called Marxists or communists or socialists, are they?
No, they're persuading a lot of the public every time they get us to use words that we know aren't true. So they work on things like pronouns. And you think, well, pronouns are stupid. This guy was born a guy. Just because he dresses up like a girl and pretends he's a woman doesn't make him a woman. So I'm not going to call him she, and I'm not going to call him they. I'm going to call him him. Frankly, I've done my own form of rebellion. I just call them it. And that's really, it gets very upset because they say it's dehumanizing. They say you're tearing yourself physically to pieces and you're calling themselves in the plural and you say I'm dehumanizing you and I'm calling you it. So no. But every time each one of us, we go along with it because, oh, we have a family member this way or one of our kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews is in college and they're flirting with this nonsense and they're getting, you know, deceived this way. And so you want to have the peace at Thanksgiving or Christmas and you're not going to bring it up or you're going to, you know, be nice about it or whatever. So if we stop in our own lives speaking about what's right and what's wrong, then we're surrendering.
If we say wokeness, that it's got an interesting definition or connotation. And then we have the word decay. Are they becoming both the same thing here anymore because of what's happening to our lexicon, to our speech?
Yeah, words are losing their meanings and their meanings are being changed on purpose. And then we end up, you know, adopting words on our own just to define what we see. And to define what's going on, because really, there was not a word for what we call wokeness before. You know, that whole attitude and that whole approach and that whole attempts to force things on all of us and silence us and destroy us. We didn't have a word for that in the English language before. So then we end up adopting our own words.
Michael Waller, I don't know how people operate that work in the Kremlin, because pretty much everything that goes around the Kremlin in Moscow, KGB, FSB, is a lie. And I'm not sure how they, or it's twisted, or it's fabricated, or it's just plain false or concocted. I don't know how maybe they grade things and go, this is on a scale of 1 to 10, the truth in this is a 2, or the truth in this is an 8. I almost feel like we need to start grading things ourselves here and, you know, put some kind of rating to it such that we're sending out caution. We see it in textbooks. We see it in movies. We see it in TV commercials. I mean, it's fascinating to me that if you look at real estate listings, now, real estate listings have taken out the word master bedroom. Now they're calling it a primary room, primary bedroom.
Oh.
See what I'm saying? Because master
so
has...
So instead of being master, you're being prime?
Well...
Oh, so it's a racist bedroom.
Yes. Did you notice that?
I hadn't heard that one, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh, it's a fact.
They can't even say in this new lexicon put out by the intelligence community, you can't even say odd terms like cakewalk. I don't use the word, but you know, you understand it's something that's really easy to do. You can't say that because it's racist, because someone somewhere back in history used it as a term regarding something to do with southern forms of racism or prejudice or customs that are viewed as unsavory. So you can't even say that. You can't say blackmail. You can't say so many things that we were just normal parts of speech that have nothing to do with race, like master bedroom, and got to be silenced about it.
Is this fixable?
It's fixable. First and foremost, it takes each and every one of us to stand up and say, this is nonsense. So if you're on Zillow or Redfin or Realtor.com and they're saying master bedroom, and or you're working with an agent and they're changing the word and say, don't give me that crap about master bedroom. Mm-hmm. They're looking for their ever diminishing commissions. So make them earn it by using proper vocabulary. First of all, what we see in schools, we have to call it out. What we see with teachers, we have to call them out. What we can do at school boards, we have to call them out, even if it means the FBI coming in and harassing us or worse. As long as you're within the law, you're within the law. So we can't allow the creepy elements of society and the enforcement arms of this ideological revolution, like the FBI or like the Justice Department, we can't allow them to intimidate us.
Well, yeah, but you know, people are slow to learn, but once they learn, they're slow to unlearn. And you know, people have a significant fear of our agencies and historically and what they do. You know, if you still say you yeah. can't sue the federal government, people believe that, but you can sue the federal government.
And you can hold them accountable, and they all have houses, and they all have, you know, kids, and they all have roots to work. They're just people, and these are just bureaucracies, and bureaucracies can change, and our country's not going to collapse because we don't have certain bureaucracies. So when they've abused their power, we need to demand from our lawmakers, our elected officials, you know, all the obvious stuff, but it hasn't worked so far. We need to demand that Donald Trump to... you know, who really could have done a lot more the first time,
yes.
and for some reason chose to put the CIA in charge of itself, and chose to put somebody like Chris Wray running the FBI, who's just a wimp anyway. He's not some tough guy. He's a Washington lawyer who made millions in the swamp, who got rotated in and out of senior position in government, and then became FBI director. So he's really just a guy who milked the public all his life to make millions of dollars, and then he's FBI director. But he's being pushed around by all these purple-haired lunatics inside the nerve system of the FBI. What you suggested before, marking them, marking their homes in a, let's call it a hypothetical
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, brand them and, you
yeah,
know, let's...
Whatever's legal. Whatever's legal, but not to harm anybody, but certainly to let everybody know this is who is here. This is what they're doing to us, because they're going to fear overstepping their bounds if they know there's going to be a price for them to pay. And a lot of that price, especially for people in the swamp and people in politics, a lot of that price is ostracism. We can't be nice anymore.
I often say that we have become so risk adverse that risk adverse is the risk itself. Yes?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And they bank on this risk aversion. They know they can win if we're risk averse, because mm-hmm. most people, it's their nature just to hunker down and to comply and to allow ourselves to be pushed around, and those who stand up to it, you know, they're made examples of very quickly and in some very ugly ways.
You know, as we were leaving Afghanistan, you had a bunch of, I think it was CIA people, or maybe it was State Department people, who wrote several letters or emails dissenting on what was happening there. And I think the House Oversight Committee is in fact trying to get their hands on all those dissenting cables or emails and whatnot, and they won't be released. But it would tell me that there was an awful lot of truce in those communications, such that
yes.
the woke part of CIA, FBI, State Department, defense, everything else. There are some good people in there that are trying to say it the way it needs to be said, and did say it the way it needed to be said. And because we have gone woke, because we have gone to censorship and decay, we're not going to release those. So that tells us pretty much everything we need to know about how infected all of the federal government is, that they have a louder voice than we do out here. Did I say any of that right?
You did. And this brings us back to the numbering of the rating system that you had suggested before. Because now in the CIA and in the FBI, they have rating systems for all their personnel. about how woke they are. And if you do not have a high wokeness score, you will not get promoted. It's part of the promotion formula. So if you don't have to just comply in a nice collegial way and go along with DEI or whatever latest gender fad there is, you have to endorse it. You have to put aside your principles and endorse it. It's called being an ally, quote, ally. It's the official term. And if you're not an ally, then you're not collegial. If you're not collegial, you're contributing to a toxic work environment, and therefore you're a bad employee and probably not trustworthy, so you will not be promoted unless you go along. That's why you have so few people coming out of the system to warn about it.
Over the weekend, Dearborn, Michigan, we had a bunch of Palestinian Hamas sympathizers that were chanting death to America. But they get away with that, words that we out here, if we said that, it would be insurrection. But for them, it's not. So there's right. yet another kind of example. Yes, Michael?
Oh, you've got agents of the government of Iran in our country stirring this up. That person you pointed out or mentioned in Dearborn, if it's the same one I'm thinking of, was a Iranian government agent.
Mm-hmm.
Here among us, given a visa or crossing the border, however they got here, but they're allowed to be in this country to foment enemy agitation and propaganda.
Well, I'm not sure they got here. I think that somewhere between CARE and, you know, some of these other organizations, they're actually being paid. They get a stipend from, you know, Russian operatives or Iranian operatives in order to do this.
You have a lot of the money coming out of
Qatar?
Shanghai, China to fund mm-hmm. these. Qatar is one of the most notorious here, and the intelligence community in the Pentagon will defend that jihadist monarch, you know, to the death, because he is ever so kindly allowing us to make use of his territory for the U.S. Central Command.
Well,
this is how he buys us off to keep us quiet about him.
Yeah, and if you go to call them out, like, you know, a handful of members of the press that necessarily might be trying to do the right thing and ask some questions of Karine Jean-Pierre or John Kirby in the White House, you know, they equivocate. They give you an answer that's not the answer. And so they respond such that the response is shaming on you for even bringing it up. So don't
right.
do it again.
And every time a government official does that, you know you have nailed it by asking that question.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you keep pushing every time they equivocate, and especially when they cast aspersions. So and you have very few reporters in the White House press corps doing that because they all want access.
Well, I think you have a few, but they've been called out. You know, the White House, I think this White House operates very much like the Obama White House does, and they send out memos to the news operatives, if you will, virtually every morning and says, this is what we need you to talk about today, you know, on the air. And they're using the same words.
Right.
So, you know, news is being manipulated to us. And I guess it also goes to Hollywood. It goes to the ad agencies. And so it's all over TV, regardless of whether it's news or you're just watching something innocent like the Discovery Channel. Right.
Right. Oh, it's on there too. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
and if you're in the news business, you have to go along if you want to have access.
Sell us your book before you go.
So the book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. And it has been available at Costco, but I think it's running out at Costco. So I wouldn't go there just for that. But you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million. Any place else books are sold. The best deal right now is Amazon.
Thanks so much for sharing some time with us. I appreciate it. I read the reviews of the book, and they're all outstanding. So thanks for writing it. Thanks for sharing some time with us. Well done, J. Michael Waller. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure having you along for the ride. We'll see you again very soon.
The Conversation Starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.